So the title of my talk today is Environmental Processes and the Evolution of Galaxies and Clusters. I'd like to start my talk by motivating the topic with just saying that there are a few observational things that we really need to explain out there. The first is, what is the evolutionary sequence that is responsible for producing the types of galaxies that we see in clusters in the present day? Ever since Wiki, we've known that the types of galaxies we see in the centers of rich clusters nowadays are very different from that of the field, and therefore we do expect that there should have a different formation or certainly a different evolutionary process that formed them. If you take a look at the diagram down here, this is the morphology density relationship from clusters first observed by Dressler, published in 1980. This is a reanalysis that he did recently, showing that as you look to higher and higher densities within a galaxy cluster, you do see a morphological change in the fraction of the different galaxies you see, with ellipticals and S0s dominating the cores or dominating the dense areas, and the spirals pretty much avoiding those areas altogether. Certainly, there's a very strong environmental effect at work here, and we'd like to know what's going on. So what are the physical mechanisms that play a role here? It's generally believed that clusters are rather nasty places for galaxies to live, and so we can come up with a list, pretty good list of bad things that can happen to good galaxies that happen to stumble their way into a cluster. One is ram pressure stripping, which can remove gas reservoirs from the galaxy as it interacts with the hot X-ray intercluster medium, which we do see in many clusters up to very high redshifts. Another possibility are galaxy-galaxy interactions, which we've seen, had plenty of discussion on before. And also there's the possibility that simply tidal disruption of galaxies can also perturb them to the point where they stop forming stars and may eventually aid their transformation from a field-like population into the population we see in clusters today. A second compelling observational fact is this thing we call the Butcher-Omler effect. And it'd be awfully nice to be able to frame our discussion on the evolution of cluster galaxies in a way that will also explain the Butcher-Omler effect. The Butcher-Omler effect is shown here in two different diagrams taken from two different, very, very different observational strategies. The one on the left is from Rakos and Schombert, based on narrowband imaging of galaxy clusters. The one on the right is from the CNOC clusters, based in part on spectroscopy of clusters. You can see that the general trend is that at low redshift, the galaxy cores are dominated by early type or by reddish galaxies. As you go to higher and higher redshifts, you start seeing a larger fraction of galaxies in the core. Excuse me? Well, this is a view graph that Peter von Dockham very nicely let me borrow for this talk. You can see here that there is still a trend through these rather disparate different groups of clusters here. We have got X-ray clusters in here, optically selected clusters, and of course MS-1054 on the right-hand side. If you do take the clusters as a whole together, you do see a Butcher-Omler effect. The CNOC clusters, in general, I don't have time to put them on, they occupy this area roughly in here. The scatter is large on a lot of these samples, particularly the X-ray samples, but the Butcher-Omler effect is there, perhaps not as dramatic as you might see from the original Butcher-Omler clusters in this region, but we do see a Butcher-Omler effect even in the X-ray selected samples, contrary to some recent reports. Yes? For that one, for all higher redshift clusters, there's usually a significant field contamination that you need to subtract statistically. So that would be a very red cluster that's actually redder than the field. Excuse me? For this one, the error bars, unfortunately, are not available for these particular points. Mm-hmm. For the CNOC clusters, the error bars I showed you there are actually larger than you would get from a purely photometric sample, since that was a spectroscopically confirmed membership as well. Photometric errors have the possibility of more systematics for individual clusters, but the error bars are a little bit smaller. Ha 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 ha. So the question is, that's been stated before, why then not now? Why do we see these extra blue galaxies in the cores or in the regions of clusters at high redshift, but not so many in the present? Possibilities, is that some of the possibilities is that there is actually a change in the mechanism that is at work in the environment. The environments are physically different at higher redshift in these clusters. Another possibility is that the field galaxies, which ostensibly are still raining in on these clusters to some extent, are actually different, and therefore we're seeing a population of extra blue field galaxies that are really have nothing to do with the environment altogether. A third possibility is, or actually a third topic is, what is the relationship between the Butcher-Ulmer effect and cluster formation? And Guinevere has given us a little introduction as to some ways to think about that. One of the things that strikes me as being particularly worrisome about the Butcher-Ulmer effect is when you take a look at the X-ray luminosity function of rich clusters, you find that there's relatively little evolution from redshift of 1 down to 0. Things seem like they're more or less stable. So why then do we see such reportedly dramatic evolution in the galaxy populations over really a much smaller time scale? So being a good observer, I'd just like to put our observations in the framework of what we actually can do observationally. What we get when we go to the telescope is essentially statistical measurements of galaxy properties. And we can get luminosity functions, colors. If we've got the Keck, we can get fundamental plane data and get mass to light ratios. We can get morphologies with HST at high redshift and directly at low redshift. So we can get a sort of a laundry list of what these galaxies look like. At the same time, we can also take measurements, usually also statistical in nature, of the environment. Galaxy density, ICM density, and the position of the galaxies relative to their close neighbors and also within the large structure of the cluster. So we take these lists of one versus the other and we scramble them together and look for correlations and hope that these correlations, should we see them, will give us some idea of what the physical mechanisms are that are at work. Now, also being a good observer, I feel compelled to also write down what do we worry about, particularly for observations at clusters at moderate to high redshifts. One of the biggest problems, and I will come back to this, is that I think our cluster samples are actually very limited as far as the sorts of clusters that we're seeing at various redshifts. Certainly, we are limited in the mass range we can look at any given redshift, and also there may be some systematic effects concerning the galaxy type or the morphology. How representative are any of our cluster samples to actually tell us what's going on in the universe? There are, of course, the observational redshift effects, K corrections, the fact that a galaxy observed in the rest UV looks very different from a galaxy observed in the rest red frame. We know about these things. We're for the most part, observers are taking care of them and doing the right thing observationally. Contamination from field galaxies is a huge problem at high redshift, especially if you start looking outside of the cluster core, where the contamination rates can be up to 90% of the galaxies you see. Field galaxy evolution, you want to look at a differential evolution between field and cluster, you need to know the field galaxy evolution. Then there are the analysis problems, machine classification or by eye classification. Peter mentioned a little bit about this earlier, about the problems of doing eyeball classification on noisy undersampled data for looking at morphologies at high redshift, and I'll repeat that there. It is definitely a concern. And then finally, there's always the problem of completeness. Because we can never observe perfectly complete samples, we always have the distasteful problem of either throwing away perfectly good data or correcting the data we have to make up for imaginary objects we haven't seen, but we are sure they're there. So, and of course, there are always the usual problems of uncertainties, and particularly the scatter that these uncertainties put into our distributions. So this is my laundry list of things we worry about. You theorists are probably thinking you're going to go back and bury yourselves in your simulations, but I do want to say that there are some advantages in observing the real universe. Now, Peter gave a very good review of the evolution of early type galaxies, and so I'm very proud to show this diagram for the fourth or maybe fifth time this conference, but I'll confine myself to a couple of editorial remarks. The main one I want to say about the early type galaxies is that I think it's remarkable that so many different methods are coming up with more or less the same idea, that the early type galaxies really are an old population. We've got color magnitude diagrams, absorption lines, mass to light ratios, and they're basically building a picture where this particular component of the cluster population forms early and observes passively from there on. Very rarely do we get such synergy in cluster studies. I did want to mention that I'm really intrigued with the new results for MS-1054. The color magnitude is very nice. It shows a nice old population, as we might expect. These red mergers, I think, are really very interesting in that they're not really what we expect at all at high redshift. The fact that they're red, and they are really strikingly different from other mergers that we see, the fact that they're red indicates that whatever has happened to those something has happened to those galaxies prior to their merging into the cluster that has turned them red, that have stripped their star formation. That means that whatever environmental process is at work at redshift 0.8 has already been at work at these galaxies, possibly in their smaller subclumps, before they actually come into the potential. Remember that MS-1054 has a very high X-ray luminosity, it's very rich, and also has a high X-ray temperature, which is usually an indication of a very well-developed potential. So one possibility is that the influence of these very rich clusters may actually spread into the field, into the regions around it, to affect galaxies that will eventually fall in. So in a sense, pre-processing, just by being such a rich cluster and spreading its influence out to very large radii. So on to the evolution of the disk population. Again, Peter gave us another introduction on this, and this is not the first time you've seen this diagram, I'm sure. The standard paradigm at this point is that we have a relatively high fraction of S0 galaxies at low redshift and a relatively low one at high redshift. Now, Peter also showed a view graph showing that there have been some challenges to this based on machine classification of galaxies versus by eye classification. My editorial comment on that is that I'm very nervous with the idea that the Dressler et al. Group has misclassified up to a third of the early type galaxies. That seems a rather radical result. At the same time, I think it really needs to be looked into, and some of these classifications really do have to be confirmed so that we really know what sort of galaxies we're looking at. The standard paradigm goes on then to say that it seems very reasonable that spiral galaxies, field-like spiral galaxies falling into the cluster, are somehow transformed through some yet unknown mechanism into this S0 population. Now, this idea that galaxies are adversely affected after they fall into the cluster potential really is very, very reasonable. We have ample evidence that star formation in clusters is suppressed throughout the entire cluster region. What I have here is a plot from Balak et al. 1998 showing the cumulative fraction of the oxygen 2 width as a function of cluster radius. This is a field sample taken at the same redshift as the clusters. And so this is a coeval field. You can see as you go from the field into smaller and smaller radii, you can see less and less star formation, or more and more of the effects of the cluster potential. So it seems as though we have a very simple situation here. We could look at the clusters in a very simple way, that as you look closer and closer into the cluster center, you're seeing galaxies that have had more and more of a chance to be affected by whatever environmental mechanism is at work in the cluster. But then there is a question, is this galaxy evolution, this transformation of galaxies once they enter the cluster, is it characterized by starbursts? This is something that has seen a lot of work in the literature to try to figure out what is going on. It was first spurred by, well, first the Butcher-Ohmler effect, the fact that there are excess blue galaxies. But again, when you compare to the coeval field, it turns out that many of these excess blue galaxies really are normal field spirals. And there doesn't seem to be a large systematic effect of extra star formation in the cluster at any radius, at any time. But there are these galaxies that were first called E+A galaxies, now called K+A galaxies, which have strange spectra, which are indicative that there might have been extra star formation in some galaxies at some point. Here's a sample spectrum showing the E part, which would be an elliptical type spectrum or a passive K-star type spectrum, with extra Balmer lines. H-delta is particularly prominent in these spectra. The interpretation of these galaxies is that we have a galaxy star forming, or in the case of galaxies called high H-delta systems, possibly not with a lot of star formation, undergoing some sort of burst of star formation upon entry into the cluster, encompassing maybe 10-20% of its mass. Now, a couple of studies have shown that some high redshift clusters that have been studied, show a very large fraction of these galaxies, these post-starburst galaxies, and also actual starbursts whether regular starbursts or also a possible population of starbursts that are partially occluded by dust in the clusters. This active fraction can reach up to 20% in some samples. Now, there's also been some evidence recently reported by Smale et al. That when you look at some of these clusters in the at long wavelengths in the radio, you also see evidence that there is star formation going on in these clusters, and again, some of which we're not even seeing because of the dust. So the question is, what are these? How much extra star formation is going on? How important are these bursts in most clusters? I do want to mention, though, that there is a new preprint out on AstroPH from Jones, Smale, and Couch that say, well, let's hold off on the starburst idea for a moment, simply because what we see with the S0 galaxies may, their study with the S0 galaxies is based on absorption lines, and they tend to find that the S0 galaxies look as old as the ellipticals in the field. This implies that they probably have not seen any of these starbursts, and the starburst phenomenon may not actually be related to the transformation, the formation of S0s. Okay, I welcome your editorial comment. So what's going on with the morphologies? HST observations allow us to make a general statistical statement on what are the morphologies of the starburst and post-starburst galaxies. They tend to be associated with mergers. Not every time, but enough that there seems to be a causal connection between these active galaxies and the merging population. But as Couch et al. And others have noted, there seems also to be a significant population of galaxies that could not have undergone or are undergoing a merger. Galaxies that are having their star formation truncated, but through somehow gentler means that allow the disk structure to remain. Now, the starburst question was something we also looked at with the CNOT clusters. This is a plot from Balch et al. 1999. We took our oxygen 2 and H delta measurements and the distribution of points on the H delta O2 graph. The E plus A galaxies or K plus A galaxies are the ones up in this corner here. This is the region where the Morse group found something like 20% of the population living, and you can see that just with the raw fraction, we see something like 4 or 5%. Our raw field fraction, these guys here, are somewhat less than 2%. But I also want to note that there's a significant effect due to the fact that observations always have error bars, and this is going to scatter distributions. If you look at the huge lump of early-type galaxies we see sitting here, and if you take a look at average error bars, you can see that a large fraction of those galaxies are actually going to be scattered up into that K plus A box. If you make a correction for the scatter, our K plus A fraction comes down to about 1.5%, the field fraction about 1%, and we can actually say we don't see a very strong evidence at all for any sort of starburst or post-starburst galaxies in these clusters. Now, one can look for these so-called Butcher-Omler galaxies in other places as well. At low redshift, Caldwell et al. And Caldwell and Rose have taken a look at spectra of abnormal spectra of galaxies in low redshift clusters and have found examples of E plus A galaxies, primarily in regions that look like they're undergoing some sort of substructure merger. And I want to note that this is a fairly significant thing, that suddenly now we have a connection between E plus A galaxies and larger scale structure as well. E plus A's are also seen in the field, and Zabludoff has done a survey for them, and she finds a tiny fraction of E plus A galaxies in the field, but it is significant to note that that means that whatever makes these guys is not a cluster-specific mechanism. Finally, in a brand new study, Moss and Whittle have found that circumnuclear H-alpha emission in galaxies in low redshift clusters seems, first of all, it's evident, and so you do see these little excess star formation outside the nucleus in these galaxies, and that there seems to be a relationship. And this is, I think, new stuff, and I'm not sure how well it will stand, but there may be a relationship where you see more of this phenomenon for richer clusters, which might indicate it's actually a tidal effect, that it's something having to do with the overall cluster potential depth to transform these galaxies in some way. So I have to say that after looking at high redshift galaxies for a long time, I'm very impressed that at low redshift you can see things so much better. And actually, specifying what is the mechanism, if we're careful about choosing which galaxies we look at, finding this phenomenon happening in the last few pocks at low redshift may actually be the way to go in determining what the mechanism is. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have a reasonable sequence from not so many in the field, more in groups, and even more in the clusters then. So we have a tricky situation here where we didn't find Butcher-Omler galaxies in high redshift clusters where we expect them. We did find them in low redshift clusters where we didn't expect them. So what's going on? I think one way of untangling this is simply by stating something that in retrospect might seem a little obvious. The galaxy populations we see in a cluster are actually just a strong function of the recent merger history in that particular cluster. The low redshift studies looked at clusters that just had undergone merging and they found them there. Now, with the high redshift studies, we may be able to explain what's going on with the Morphs group versus the CNOC result and optical versus X-ray selected populations in general by noting that the X-ray selected clusters really do seem to be overall more homogeneous. They often have cooling flows. They're really a much more quiescent population than the optically selected clusters, which may be selected to have a little bit more action going on. So when you put all of this together, what we have is an idea that interactions in starbursts, although very interesting to look at, they may actually not be a universal mechanism. There actually probably are a lot of quiescent clusters where some other mechanism is at work transforming the population. Excuse me? Yes, we do have, yeah, they have some clusters that are strong X-ray sources as well. What happened? Well, we actually, no, we don't. But although, rather strangely, there's at least one cluster where Mike can tell us, what was our overlap in 0016? So we can discuss that during the question session if you want. But again, you know, the lesson here, sample selection. I'll just leave it at that. So now we have a clear link between the merger history of the clusters and what the populations are doing. And so in the last part of my talk, what I'd like to do is to tell you, is to explain a little bit about what we're seeing with the relationship between the populations and the cluster structures in a larger scale. This is work I have been doing with Juan Lin down at University of Arizona and Howard Yi. And what we do is, instead of looking at the individual galaxies, instead we use a principal component analysis technique in order to pull the stellar populations out of the individual galaxies and look at the old populations and the younger populations separately. This is also rather convenient because it allows us to make field corrections and do other sort of nifty things with the data, which are very hard when the data are stuck onto individual discrete galaxies sitting out there in space. What we do is that we decompose all of the galaxy spectra from the CNOC survey into a sum of three components. The components were originally defined from the Las Campanas Redshift Survey, a very large, low redshift galaxy survey. And we have an emission line component, a bomber line component, an elliptical component. So if you can imagine taking a spectrum and describing it as a fraction in each of those three components, which does actually take care of most of the luminosity that we see in these galaxies. To orient you in this new parameter space, here's emission component versus Balmer component, and the labels are galaxies from the Chemiket Atlas. 0, 0, we see mostly elliptical to early type galaxies. You can see the sequence of spirals to IM. Now, you notice that there are no Chemiket galaxies here. These open circles are actually K plus A galaxies from the CNOC survey. So you can see these are Balmer strong, emission weak. So this should all make relative sense there. We can take these PCA components, add them up for all the galaxies, weight them properly according to the observational completeness limits of the sample, and come up with population gradients as a function of R over R200 for all 16 clusters at intermediate redshift. And what we see is, again, really not very surprising. The elliptical component goes down with radius, the emission and the Balmer go up with radius. These points here are the field, are values from the same PCA analysis from the CNOC 2 field survey with the emission and then the Balmer and elliptical components there. Now, the interesting thing about the PCA components is that now we have everything on this nice little coordinate system. Let's crank it around. So we can redefine the coordinate system now so that one axis is the cluster axis. So this is a new, this is not the same as elliptical, although it's very, very, very close. It's defined by the reddest galaxies that we see in the centers of the clusters and is also consistent with spectral synthesis models as well. The field component is defined by the CNOC2 field galaxy surveys as a function of redshift. And so in this component, we take out the evolution of the field galaxies. And so what we see here now is a differential measure relative to the field galaxy sample. The third component is post-star formation. I say that instead of post-burst because it also takes into account galaxies whose star formation have merely been truncated. And here's the component here as well. You can see that now the gradients do what they should do. You go from 100% cluster in the core down to 0%, and you also see the expected asymptotic behavior from zero field galaxies up to nearly 100% field galaxies. The PSS looks relatively flat, which means that what relatively little light we have in the Balmer component is actually has a relatively flat distribution throughout the cluster, so intermediate between the two. These are from spectra, yes. These are rotations of the original components.
Linear combinations.
Linear combinations.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
It's a linear combination with the three. Well, okay, the new axes that define the new coordinate system, the first one is defined by the values of the reddest properties of the reddest cluster galaxies. The second one, the field or field-like component, is defined by the CNOC field galaxies, and that's as a function of redshift. Okay, so that actually, so each cluster has a slightly different rotation, slightly different coordinate transform. And the third one is from post-star formation galaxies. And what I should say is that depending on exactly what you use for these two, there is going to be a little bit of a slot back and forth as to what the gradients look like, but qualitatively they behave the same way. And again, it is, as Simon said, it's the expected behavior that we chose the coordinates to show, going from cluster dominated in the center to field dominated on the outskirts. Mm-hmm. Excuse me? All projection, yes. Excuse me? The most I would say in the post-star formation galaxies is that their distribution appears to be intermediate between the old population and the young population. Okay? You can see that we see relatively little Balmer component, and so you know, it's not really clear that we have enough data to really say definitively what it's doing. Now, we can look at these gradients as a function of redshift, and here we've just taken the same components but divided them into two samples, one at redshift greater than 0.3, one at redshift less than 0.3. And what you see is an evolution, reasonably clear evolution in what the gradients are doing. Now, this also shouldn't be surprising because this is the Butcher-Omler effect, or certainly a restatement of the Butcher-Omler effect. If you remember, the Butcher-Omler effect is defined by looking at a certain aperture and counting diffraction of blue galaxies within that aperture. Certainly, at higher redshift, you will see more of these blue galaxies or more of the star-forming galaxies than at this. The interesting thing is that all of these clusters appear to be just as red as every other cluster in the very cores. And that's something that I think that a lot of people have noted as well, expressing surprise when MS-1054, for example, has a lot of red galaxies in the center, despite the fact that it is at high redshift. No, this is relative to the field galaxies. So it's very slightly different, not enough to make a huge difference, I should say. We do the, so these are all gradients relative to the field. And so this takes out the effect that the field galaxies at redshift 0.6 might be a little bit bluer than the field galaxies at redshift 0.2. Now, to show you that this is also something that is not terribly frightening at first glance, I've also plotted here, these are apples and orange, but if you look at the morphological fraction of different sorts of galaxies from other samples that have better morphology data than I'm plotting here, you can see that you see the same thing. Here's the Dressler et al. 1997 data, and you can see they also see for their concentrated clusters a relatively similar gradient in what's going on. And this is data that, again, it's apples and oranges, is the E plus S0 population from Whitmore, Gilmore, and Jones. And so again, you can see that this sort of gradient actually has been out there in the literature already. Now, we can easily convert these to looking at luminosity surface densities. And what I want to point out here is that the old cluster population appears to, again, dominate in the center and have a fairly steep distribution. The younger populations, as has been noted by a lot of other people, have a relatively flatter distribution, have a more extended distribution. If you look at these surface densities as a function of redshift, what we see is rather nice. These two curves, one for the higher and one for the lower redshift distribution, are independently normalized, and so the fact they lie right down on top of each other is really an independent process. It's really an independent parameter. You can see that the two curves are really very, very similar. It appears that the old population, the old spectral population, is in a relatively stable spatial / dynamical state within the cluster. The young population, on the other hand, in order to give us a Butcher-Omler effect, is evolving with redshift. And you can see at high redshift and low redshift, you have more or less the same shape outside of the quarry areas where we don't know what's going on. These points are on top of the CD galaxies. And I'm not sure what's going on, again, in the inner 300-400 kiloparsecs. But certainly on the outside parts, you can see what looks like curves that have more or less the same shape, which are simply decreasing in amplitude. So the question is, how can we interpret what's going on? One of the more straightforward ways of interpreting what we see here is that we're seeing a change in infall rates into the clusters at higher redshift and at lower redshift. That would give you a roughly similar shape that would decrease in amplitude. Some of the things that have been brought up as problems with interpreting the Butcher-Omler effect are more or less taken care of with the PCA analysis. We normalize for at least the first orders of cluster mass by doing everything versus R over R200, and also by choosing the coordinates relative to the field galaxies, we also take out the field component, the effects of the field galaxy evolution as well. For these clusters, we see no real change in the ICM density, and so really we're not finding any systematic differences in the environmental mechanisms that are at work in these clusters. We don't see any strong evidence for excess starbursts and mergers in these particular samples as well. And so what's really left to explain the Butcher-Omler effect? It really could be that we are seeing a difference in infall. One of the other possibilities is that the galaxies at higher redshift, even though we've taken out the obvious observational effect that they may be bluer or have more star formation, perhaps are a little bit more resilient to the cluster population. But if that were to happen, what we would find is that the galaxy surface luminosities would, in a sense, tend to go from a distribution that's a little bit more like the older galaxies in the cluster to a flatter distribution. And therefore, we'd see gradients in fraction that would have the same change in slope from steeper to flatter, but would actually go in this direction rather than the other direction that we actually see in the clusters, which has similar fractions in the center and an increasing Butcher-Omler effect as you look out to the edges. So let me just put up my summary. The two questions I asked before, what's the evolutionary sequence for galaxies and clusters? Well, ellipticals probably form early, and there's a lot of very good evidence for that. Again, there's always the question of the stars forming versus the actual galaxies we see forming, whether there's been hierarchical merging that plays a role there. For the S0s, we're still a little up in the air until we understand what's going on with the real fraction of S0s and clusters, but again, I'm happy with the standard paradigm for the meantime. but with the caveat that what's going on with these galaxies is probably a mere truncation of star formation rather than something which requires a starburst for it to happen. What causes the evolution in galaxy populations with redshift? The Butch-Romer effect does really exist for the X-ray selected samples, although it seems that it's very much a function of what sort of galaxy cluster you're looking at. The original Butch-Romer samples seem to have the highest Butch-Romer effect, but the X-ray samples, although less dramatic, do actually see it. We don't see any obvious changes in the environments of the X-ray clusters, and that brings us to believe that it could be simply the effect of additional infall at higher redshift that's causing the Butch-Romer effect. So I'll stop there. Thank you.